my love of language and my love of natural language processing sort of merged together, and I started studying computational linguistics under a professor, Hal Dalmay, who actually now works at Microsoft Research part-time and also teaches at a university in Maryland. And so that's where it all started. And then I wanted to see if I could figure out the marriage of language and AI to see if we could do something about that. Because, you know, it turns out the history of that is interesting. Americans tried to write computer programs that would translate from Russian to English during the Cold War, and it was so bad that they were like, this is never going to work. And so they tried a bunch of things. And now it's so good that if it translates it wrong, it's kind of like a novelty. Oh, look, it got this wrong.
Welcome to Latinx in Power, a podcast hosted by Thaisa Fernandes.
Welcome to Latinx in Power. I have received an invitation from my friends at Microsoft to attend the Microsoft Build event. And I'm thrilled to share that today I'm here in Seattle and we have the incredible opportunity to engage in a conversation with Seth Juarez. Seth Juarez works in the API platform group at Microsoft. He holds a bachelor degree in computer science from UNLV with a minor in mathematics and completed his master's degree in computer science at the University of Utah. Seth's main area of interest revolve around artificial intelligence, specifically in machine learning and quantum computing. I'm so excited. Welcome, Seth.
Hello. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. I'm so excited with our conversation. So today, Seth will take us on a journey through AI and quantum computing, sharing insights into his personal experiences. Discover how he fosters creativity in his work and gain inspiration from a memorable project that has shaped his career. As I speak, we are recording this exclusive podcast episode right here at the Microsoft Build event venue. We aim to offer an independent perspective with our unique insights. The opinions expressed through this episode belong to myself and Seth, and we are very nice and do not necessarily represent the official positions of Microsoft. So, Seth, how are you?
I am fantastic. I am so delighted to be here today. It is the third day of Microsoft Build. I had a lot of assignments on day one and day two. This is one of the only assignments I have today, and I'm just excited to be here.
Awesome. I hope it's the best one.
Oh, of course. How could it not be?
And you have a great voice.
Oh, thank you.
Do you consider yourself a Latino?
Absolutely. As a child, my dad went to medical school when he had four kids, and he decided that in order for it to be less expensive and be able to afford it, he decided to move us to Mexico. And so I lived in Guadalajara, and my dad went to Universidad Autónoma de Guadalajara. I don't know how to say it in English. And so I actually grew up from when I was 5 until I was 8 in Mexico. I didn't know that I was actually learning Spanish, and I didn't understand that I was in a different country.
Oh.
And so my grandma and my grandfather, my grandmother passed away recently, but she lives in Sinaloa in Culiacan. And so my whole extended family is from Mexico. And so everything that I am and that I do is imbued with that heritage. And as I've studied more the history of Mexico and the Aztec and the Maya, it's just a part of who I am. And my kids, I recently took them down there. It's a part of who they are too. And they're excited to participate in such a wonderful and vibrant community.
That's incredible. I always say that life is better in Spanish.
That's right.
Right?
Or Portuguese.
I don't know. I'm biased. So it's my language. So I feel like, okay, Portuguese.
Portuguese is awesome. I love languages. I know Spanish and I've studied French. And Portuguese is like this beautiful marriage of the two. And so it's like, wow, this is so cool.
Yeah, I never thought about that. It's interesting because my favorite languages are Spanish and French. Mm-hmm. And I'm not fluent in both of them.
Yes.
But sometimes I'm talking with my partner, he's Brazilian, and people think we are speaking in French.
Oh, that's
like,
cool.
No, it's not. French is
to be fair,
prettier.
My French is good, but it's book French. Because you know how when you learn a language, especially even in Spanish or Portuguese or even French, they teach you the rules. But then when we actually speak it, there is a local flavor of how we bend the quote the rules, because there's really no rules of language. And so that's the thing. Like, I speak book French. They say your French is good. It sounds like you're speaking from a book. And it's like, like, oh, okay, I understand what that means, actually.
Yeah, yeah, it's a little bit more formal. And I always think about that, like, even maybe the jokes, the way we say things mm-hmm. is just kind of old, right? Because That's it right. comes from book.
That's right. And even like the nuances of language, to me, it's fascinating mm-hmm. how language has evolved over time to create sort of a beautiful tapestry of how we communicate information to each other. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that too. And I think it's very fascinating. Even the wording like Latinx mm-hmm. is something that I know some people love and some people hate mm-hmm. and some people have this sense that, oh, it's not quite there yet, but we are making this movement to be more inclusive. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's other ways. And I feel that it's very interesting to see the language changing and the sense that we might not getting right, but we are working with something that is very complex. I feel especially Spanish, Portuguese, mm-hmm. French, it's so much harder.
Yeah. And what people don't realize with my daughters, I have older daughters. And when we drive, I like to put on like podcasts and stuff. And the one that I put on, it was like 13 hours long by a Professor McWhirter about the history of language. And we learned how like language isn't a static thing. And so when someone says speak correctly, that doesn't really mean anything, especially in English. Like if they say, hey, you're not speaking correct English. Well, should I start saying thou hast not been amongst my people? You know, should I be speaking like Shakespearean? Is that the correct English? Or should I speak like a British person with their accent? Or should I speak like languages have evolved? You know, for example, when the British came and to Latin America, or the Dutch, because there's parts of Latin America where they still speak parts of Dutch. Like, is that the correct Dutch or where? And so there's a way to actually linearly see where all of the languages came from and how they've evolved. And so if they were to say to me, speak correct Spanish, I would say, do you mean Latin? And if you mean Latin, which kind, right? And so that's why, to me, my daughters and I came to the conclusion that if we understand one another, that's language.
Yes. I love that.
Yeah.
And Seth, can you tell us how everything started?
Oh, yeah. So we've kind of gone off into this language area. It turns out that my fascination with language converted over to artificial intelligence. And that sounds like a weird jump. But I remember I did my undergraduate work. I started actually in civil engineering because I like math and I like that kind of stuff. And then I realized I don't want to play with dirt outside my whole life. And I got a job where I was like a QA guy at a B2B e-commerce company called Purchase Pro, which doesn't exist anymore. And I remember one of the programmers there saw some macro I did in Excel a long time ago. And he's like, that was pretty good. You should be a programmer. And just that one thing stuck in my mind. And then I went and lived in Spain for a couple of years. And when I came back to finish my college degree, I switched immediately from civil engineering to computer science. And I thought it was delightful. Became a programmer, then wanted to do my master's degree. I sat in my first machine learning class. And it was a very simple algorithm. It's called K-means. It's a clustering algorithm. And all it does is if you say, I want to find two centers to these two data points, it basically measures the distance and it iteratively finds the best two centers. And as I was watching, it was in MATLAB, as I was watching the computer reason and find the centers of two dense points, I was fascinated. And I thought, oh, look, the computer's thinking. But then the second thought was, but it isn't, because I know exactly mathematically what's happening. And that's where my love of machine learning started. And then I worked with the professor, Dr. Ellen Ryloff. She's amazing. And her research was in the area of NLP or natural language processing. And so like my love of language and my love of natural language processing sort of merged together. And I started studying computational linguistics under Professor Hal Dalmay, who actually now works at Microsoft Research part-time and also teaches at a university in Maryland. And so that's where it all started. And then I wanted to see if I could figure out the marriage of language and AI to see if we could do something about that. Because, you know, it turns out the history of that is interesting. Americans tried to write computer programs that would translate from Russian to English during the Cold War, and it was so bad that they were like, this is never going to work. And so they tried a bunch of things. And now it's so good that if it translates it wrong, it's kind of like a novelty. Oh, look, it got this wrong. And we expect these systems to just work. And so even in my lifetime, I've seen like, this is amazing stuff. So that's the journey of how I became involved with artificial intelligence.
That's incredible. And I love that we started to talk about our passion for language. And that's incredible. And maybe we can talk more about the terminologies for folks who don't fully understand what is machine learning, for example, or even artificial intelligence or quantum computing. Can you define them?
Absolutely. So artificial intelligence is actually a very large field. It's like a field where you can make computers reason about things and what is perceived to us as a human way of reasoning. And artificial intelligence has been around, you know, for a long time, since the 50s. And we've been using artificial intelligence algorithms and we take it for granted. Like, for example, we've been using our map applications forever. And sometimes when there's traffic, it reroutes. That's a common artificial intelligence algorithm. In fact, if you want to look it up, it's called the A-Star algorithm, which helps you find paths. Have you ever played like a game of tic-tac-toe or chess against the computer? That's also an artificial intelligence algorithm. That's not machine learning. In this case, a good algorithm to look up is something called Minimax, where basically the computer, and it's easy to visualize with tic-tac-toe because if you're listening, you can visualize tic-tac-toe. It's got the 9 squares. And if I put my X on the top left-hand square, there's now only 8 positions that the computer can choose. So what the computer does is it says, I'm going to pretend I'm going to put my O in all of those 8 positions. And then what it does is on each of those 8 positions, it says, now where can Seth put his X? And now you can start building this tree and it tries to find the optimal path to win. That's a really simple, and if you're driving in a car and listening to this, you can visualize this in your head. You can see like there's one tic-tac-toe and here's all the variations of where Seth could go and here's all the variations where I could go. And you could make it so that you could never beat a computer because that space is completely explored. In spaces like chess though, it starts to get much bigger, the space to search. And so you have to cull the tree or cut things down, or maybe at a certain spot, that configuration, you do a database lookup and say, oh, this is the strategy. And so notice that that's a very, becomes a finite space. And so when we're talking about AI in general, we've been using these things for years without question. And so that's AI. And I've described some AI algorithms that are AI, but not machine learning. Machine learning starts to become important when the space to search is intractable. And the term intractable means you cannot enumerate all of the spaces. A good example of a game like that is Go. I've never played it, but I'm told that that has infinite possibilities. And now you're running out of space to say, well, if I go here, where will they go? And if you're thinking about something like language, there's no way to enumerate all the possibilities. Do you see what I'm saying? And so machine learning, what it did is it changed the way we look at AI. We changed it from a search problem to now a give it examples problem. And so basically you give it examples of a lot of information, and the supervised learning case is the easiest. You give it a lot of information with the right answer and you let the algorithm create a way to produce the answer given a new value. And you're thinking, well, that sounds super complicated, but then again, it doesn't. The easiest machine learning algorithm that everyone will understand is if you have a bunch of points in 2D space and you draw a line through it, right? You can start to predict, given an X, what's the Y if you have the line. And so that's just a simple linear regression. And that's the simplest example of machine learning algorithms. The more complicated ones that we get into, for example, with neural networks, that's a class of machine learning algorithms called deep learning that start to create separators that are much more complex than lines. And it's hard to even visualize it in your head, but they are able to solve more complex problems. Like, for example, what's the next thing I should return given a prompt? And so large language models that you know is a generative model. But if you think about it, it's been trained with examples of language. And when you feed it a prompt, it returns the next letter and it does a next token. It does that in a loop. And then that's how ChatGPT works. And so that's how you go through. AI has been around forever. If you played games with AI, machine learning flips it because the space is intractable. Deep learning has found a way to create functions that are so complex that they mimic human behavior, which is really cool. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, that's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. I think one important aspect of like everything we are talking is creativity. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you, how do you foster creativity and innovation in your work? And the second part of this question is, what advice would you give to someone pursuing a career in tech and AI?
That's a great question. So creativity. So I'm gonna answer in two ways. One, everything we do is creative. If you are making a thing, like if you literally wake up and you have a new thought, you are being creative. And so the way to foster that that is to remove, and this is maybe I'm talking mostly to myself, remove the self-doubt. And when you have a thought that's new, maybe explore it and be creative. And this works in any field, number one. Number two, there's a lot of technology today, specifically in generative AI, things like models like DALL-E or Stable Diffusion that produce images, or things like ChatGPT, which can produce prose or poetry. Those tools are amazing because what they can do is they can help collaborate with you in a way to elevate creativity. Because the thing about creativity is everyone always says, at least I get the impression, that creativity means that you've made something brand new. But the reality is you really never make anything new. What you're doing is you're putting together a bunch of things in a new way. And that's the thing that these generative tools can do, is that they can put things together in a different way that could inspire you to do the next creative thing. And that's why I love this new era of copilots, this new era of generative AI, because now what that can do is that can sort of up-level our creativity in a much faster way. Instead of having to have a blank page problem, we can start with something that the AI made and then add our human ingenuity to create even faster, even more. And now we get in the position of reviewing AI creative things to create our own human things. And I think we live in an absolutely spectacular era. And I think we're going to look back to today and realize we just started a new wave of ingenuity, much like during the first industrial revolution. We no longer had to walk everywhere or ride a horse, or we had machines that started to help us with the physical labor. Now we're going to have machines that are going to help us up-level our mental labor. And so I'm pretty excited about this.
I love that. And I really like when you said that the sense of creativity. I think, like, for me personally, the reason why I started my career as a designer, because I saw myself as a very creative person. Mm-hmm. And I thought the only way to express my creativity was being a designer. And after a while, I realized, no, I can actually be a program manager and continue to be creative and create in different ways, right?
Yes.
So I think it's important to talk about that. And another thing that I wanted to ask you, so I saw your talk here at Microsoft Build, and it was incredible. And I love how you bring your personality. And I think it's one thing that a lot of folks from Latin America struggle, right? Because we try to adapt to this new culture, yeah. We try to assimilate, and sometimes it's a little bit tricky, right? To show your authentic self. It's something that I struggled the first years I was here. I was like, oh my God, I don't know who I am in English, right? Uh-huh. And now I feel very comfortable and I have a strong personality, but I feel for some folks, it might be hard. So I wanted to hear your thoughts about it. How was this process for you, where it was always like that, you felt comfortable being yourself and showing your personality? It was something that you developed over time.
It's absolutely very difficult to go into a new space, especially one where the language is different and the culture is different. I had that sensation when I lived in Spain for a couple of years. And even though it's a Hispanic culture, it's definitely not a Latin culture. And the difference is very nuanced. You know, Hispanic is if you speak Spanish, Latin is if you live in Latin America. And for example, you can be Latin and not Hispanic, and you can be Hispanic and not Latin. And so when I lived in Spain, I thought there would be like a similarity, and there was. But it was mostly language-based. They are definitely European. And I felt like even with the same language that I had to reformulate, I felt like an outsider, even with my own, you know, native language. And so, yeah, it's hard to do that. But the reality is that we have, I don't know, 8 billion people around the world right now that are going around being way too reserved about their individuality, that we kind of just live in a reserved world. And when you are in your place of comfort and your authentic self comes out, there is a joy about that that is infectious. I don't think that's just a Latin thing, but I think for us Latinos, there is a joy that we just want to exude, you know? And it's true of a lot of cultures, and I'm not just saying it, but I know ours, right? And so I've found that people want to participate in authenticity. And once I've discovered that, I've found that my authenticity is the best when I'm helping someone else's authenticity come out. And so when you see me give talks, I'm always trying to make it so that people feel like we're all doing something together. And I have found, and this is something I'm working on at Microsoft and everywhere, that people don't remember what you told them. They remember how they feel when you told them, and they will attach that feeling to the content. And so that's what I try to bring to all of these talks, right? I want you to feel like this is great. We're all doing something cool together. And I want people to feel joy and excitement about what I'm showing because I'm genuinely excited about the stuff I work on. It's like, remember I told you at the beginning, I'm working on AI and now I'm working on tools that work with language. How exciting is this? You know, love languages, love AI. It's the perfect mixture for me. And so I try to be genuine. I try to let people participate in that excitement. And everyone that's listening should too. There's a uniqueness about every single human being that if you just don't let yourself be authentic, we're all missing out, I think, on a little bit of goodness.
Yeah. And also this connection, right?
Yeah.
You can connect with someone when they are, I don't know, authentic.
Yeah.
You might remember, as you said, a lot of things because they were like excited or they were wearing something cool and you talk about this thing. So yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And my wife actually pointed me to Brené Brown and she said something so insightful that I didn't realize that it is if you are desiring connection and you're being reserved, the connection you get will always be sterile or not real. Because if you're your authentic self, which is hard to do, then you are actually allowing other people to connect with you in a more authentic way, right? Otherwise, it's like sterile, it's inauthentic, it's not real. And that's the true test of like, if someone's, and we all are different, you know, people don't, I used to be a teacher and I have had students come and be like, hey, can I transfer classes? It devastated me. But then the longer I taught, the more I realized some people just aren't compatible and that's okay. We should celebrate that too. And if you're not authentic, you're not going to really know who your people are.
Yes. I love that. Yeah, you're giving
That's
me
Brené
a lot
Brown. That's not me. I wish I could take credit.
We love
awesome.
Brené Brown and we love to talk about Brené Brown in this podcast.
Oh,
so thank
see,
you
look
for
at that. We're like the same people here.
Yeah, I'm obsessed before I read all her books. So yes, that's incredible. And which advice would you give to other program managers who want to get into AI?
Oh, most people tend to think that AI is more of a complicated thing. And you know what? I think the reality is that there are some parts that are complicated, but not intractable. You can totally learn this stuff. There's some math involved, but the actual interaction with humans and artificial intelligence, that's something that everyone can understand. And we're going to come to a place in a couple of years where if we aren't integrating AI into a product, our consumers will think that product is fundamentally broken, right? Like, for example, you know, when you're typing and there's autocomplete or you expect your app to be connected to the internet all the time, there's going to come a time where, like, if you don't have AI in your app, people are going to, this is broken. There's something wrong with it. And the cool thing about AI is that it smooths the edges of technology around human interaction in really, really interesting ways. And so for those that think that they're not an AI person, well, it turns out that you're already participating in, kind of like when the internet, because I grew up in an interesting way because I lived half without the internet because it didn't exist, and then half with, you know? And so I remember both, and I can't remember what, I remember what it was like, you know, to not know how to get somewhere. And now it's like so nice that I just, and so there's going to come a time where we're going to look back and be like, I don't know how I didn't do this without AI. And so for those that want to get started with AI, to answer your question, we need everybody. Everyone should participate. We need diverse voices for a number of reasons, not just for the interaction piece, but for the responsibility piece and for making sure that to mitigate any particular harms that AI might do. And when you think of AI harms, I don't want you to think like robot uprising because that's not what they do. And I always stress that we do not anthropomorphize AI. Never give it like it's not human. It has no agency. It doesn't desire it. It doesn't have any of those feelings. So we need to be very vigilant when people do that so that we can protect classes against potential harms. And you're probably thinking, well, what kind of harms could it do? Well, the same kind of harms that we already have. Harms of allocation. For example, if you're a mortgage person and you use AI to give a mortgage to someone, you got to make sure that it's not biased. Or if you're a medical professional, for example, in the United States, African-American women do not get good care when it comes to giving birth. And it doesn't matter how much money you have. Serena Williams, greatest of all time tennis players, had trouble when she was giving birth because maybe, I don't know what happened, but that seems weird to me. And so we've got to be careful and vigilant with what AI systems do by analyzing data that we use to train them and then analyzing the outputs to make sure that there aren't inequities. And so that's the harm. And that notice that that's not as exciting as killer robots. And my fear is that if we go to the killer robots excitement, we're going to forget about the actual responsibility and ethics in AI, which is just the stuff that we have now, helping solve the inequities in our world,
yeah,
not amplifying them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you answered my next question already. That's incredible. Can you share a memorable experience or project that had a significant impact on your career or personal growth?
Yeah, so I'll just do, we're thinking about the now. This week, we've just released a brand new feature of our Azure AI Studio called PromptFlow, which I think is going to revolutionize the way people use large language models. And it was a lot of work, and it was a lot of people staying up late, because when ChatGPT came out, the world feels like it changed. It was the first time some of the work that I do leaked into actual just normal people, you know, on the street. And I'm not saying that I'm more normal, but just like not technologists. And I recognize that when people from high school on Facebook were like, oh, wow, this tech is so cool, and they were not in any adjacent fields to mine, I realized, oh, we're having a moment, aren't we? And we need to equip these folks with the right tools to do that. And it was like, it's been transforming over the last couple of months as we've built this tool, recognizing the good we can do and the amount of applications that it will inspire. And so I'm just going to say, like, yeah, this week has been transformative for me, as I'm hoping it'll be transformative for everyone else too.
Yeah, that's definitely an exciting moment. And I love to have you as a Latino being part of that. And I hope we have more, a lot more, and diversity in general.
Absolutely. And I would say that we need a lot of diversity in AI, because it's the diverse perspectives that allow us to be actually creative, number one, safe, number two, and it just makes for better things universally for everyone, number three, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a while. I don't go to Brazil, but I'm very curious to talk more with my mom about it.
Yeah.
I feel that I always get a lot of insights with my mom as someone that is not into tech at all. She still doesn't understand what I do. And she's trying to say program management, but she has trouble pronouncing it.
Yeah.
And now when people ask, oh, what does your daughter do? And she's like, program management, but she doesn't know how to pronounce it quite right. But this is the only thing she knows. But
cool.
I'm curious to talk more and get their insights, because it's, definitely.
It's leaked out. Not in a leak, but it's like technology that I would have never imagined. It has become the zeitgeist of just everyone. That product went from zero to like 300 million MAU in it's the fastest MAU uptake of a product ever.
Whoa.
And it's like, that's amazing.
Exciting moment. That's definitely very, very exciting. And in this podcast, we're all about sharing journeys, resources. And I love this question, because I feel we have access to a lot of resources now, but sometimes it's quite hard to find what is the right one. What is the, I don't know, because it can be very overwhelming, the amount of things we have out there now. So I'm curious to hear from you. Which resource helped you in your journey that you want to talk today?
Oh, there's a lot. The reality is that the best resource you have is your own personal desire to improve. That's something you should foster. Having said that, the thing about our field, and you know this probably better than anyone, is we are constantly learning something. And so recently, we haven't talked about quantum that much, but I've been studying quantum physics, you know, because it's just a fascinating thing. And I use that just, you know, to stretch my brain out and to learn other things. And so I've also done courses on Coursera machine learning, constantly reading papers about what's new, and then really just listening to others. And so I guess I don't have a very specific answer, other than you should always foster your desire to know something. And it's always there. Everyone has this, like, I didn't understand that. You should always put a little pin on that and be like, but I want to. And then just go look. The internet's probably the best resource to find anything. And you can find an explanation for almost anything on YouTube, although you should probably verify with another source. But yeah, I would just say the best resource for me has been, like, I just want to know how everything works. And I'm sure everyone else does too. But as soon as you like pull the thread and start pulling all of them, it's a delightful experience to learn stuff.
That's a really good advice. I think all of us have that thing. I want to learn more about that.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't prioritize. And I feel especially when it's not related to work.
Yes.
We are like, don't want to do this because, you know, like I'm not getting something out of this.
Yeah.
But in fact, yeah, that's a lot of things we can do that maybe it's going to help us professionally or maybe not, but yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah, but don't get me wrong. I'm not constantly like reading a book. I'm like sitting down watching, you know, a show too. It's okay to wind down. Like a wise man once said that someone who has his bow strung up all the time will lose the spring. You got to take the string off the bow a little bit and let it rest. And so you got to give yourself time too. So don't think I'm like advocating for always be reading a book or all. You need to take some time to relax as well, I think. Yeah. At least that's what I'm telling myself.
Yes. That's another good reminder for us, for our community, right? That
correct.
Is so used to hustle all the time, that mm-hmm. don't know how to rest mm-hmm. or feel bored. I have been thinking about that, the importance of like feeling yeah. bored. I took 9 weeks this year and I spent traveling.
Oh, that's delightful.
And I didn't work during this time and I felt bored. A lot.
Yeah, I know. And this is a problem I have. I took my family to Mexico because I was like, that's it. We're going somewhere. And I have four kids. We all went to Mexico. I took them to see the pyramids in Yucatan. They were just loving it, you know, because they're obviously Latino, but I'd never taken them to Mexico. And it was just a delightful experience. And it was cool because I didn't do anything work related. And it was nice just to spend time with them. But if I would have just been by myself, I would have gotten bored and I would have written a program or something.
Uh-huh.
And so it was nice to relax then. So yeah. You should do it if you can.
Did you go to Chichen Itza?
That's where we went.
Oh my God. I love that
yes.
place.
Mm-hmm. And the thing about these people were so educated. They bathed like 5 times a day. They had a strong sense of equality when it came to women and men and their responsibilities. They were astronomers, mathematicians, architects. It was a beautiful, beautiful culture. I wish we had more information about them. And if you ever have a chance to go down there and just admire, like yes. this, the admiration, even in just Chichen Itza, when you look at this thing, you're like, this is amazing how people did these things. And then you go to other places, like if you go to Zocalo in Mexico City, or if you go to just the Mexica, which usually are called the Aztecs, but their name was the Mexica. They were just a sometimes violent, but well-organized group of people. It's just a fascinating, fascinating history.
That's incredible. And before we go to the end, I feel that we should talk about quantum computing.
Okay.
Tell us, what is that?
Okay, so I wouldn't profess myself to be an expert. I was in charge of developer relations for AI, machine learning, and quantum. And then now I work in the product group for Azure Machine Learning. Quantum computing is an interesting way of doing computations inside quantum mechanical systems. What does that mean? Well, quantum mechanics is an interesting field of study in physics, which generated in the 1890s with Max Planck finding some really weird things with photons. And then Einstein, he got the Nobel Prize in physics for the photoelectric effect paper he wrote when he was 25. And then other physicists like Niels Bohr, among others, started to learn about, well, what happens at a very small scale. And what they learned is that tiny particles at the Planck scale don't behave like we would think. They're like nowhere and everywhere. And when you look at things, like materialize. And so Richard Feynman had an idea of creating computation on those kinds of things, where you would be able to change the state of a quantum mechanical system internally and then put them together. And so imagine, like, if you've ever seen someone doing like that rope exercise where, you know, they're putting the ropes up and down and it's making waves. Think of doing like something like that in a quantum mechanical system. But the thing that's different between a regular computer, a quantum computer, is regular computers can do zeros and ones only. Quantum computers can be in between zeros and one as well, all at the same time. And so you're able to mimic physical systems much better, and you're able to map to biological processes that in manufacturing we can't simulate. You need to like get a bacteria to make nitrogenase, for example, that's needed in almost all biological interaction. And so would it be possible to create a computer that is able to mimic natural systems and then use our computers to interface it with it like a GPU to see if we could understand natural systems a little bit better? And so that's what Connor quantum computers can do. A lot of people tend to think of quantum computers as like they're faster than regular computers. They're not. It's just a different way of doing computation that enables us to mimic physical systems much better, like chemistry, etc. And so that's why quantum computing is so interesting. It also turns out that being able to get a quantum computer into superposition, which means in between states, and then entangling quantum is quite hard. And in order to do that, you need to have very specific particles at very low temperatures. And so these things decohere quite rapidly. And so you have to have a lot of error correcting ones. And so we're still working out the hardware, but we're able to mimic quantum computers. I think it's like 40 qubits we can do. A qubit is like a one bit, but it can be between 0 and 1. And so that's why these computers are so interesting, but they're also quite hard to do. Mm-hmm. But if we're able to make them work, we can solve some very interesting biology problems that we've just never been able to do with a regular computer. And that's where I think it's very interesting. To me, it's interesting because a couple of years ago, I interviewed Krista Svore, who is one of our partner research folks. I think she's even a distinguished engineer. She's a wonderful person. And I interviewed her and I was like, wow, I really want to understand this. And so I started pulling on that thread and it just became delightful. It turns out that the physics is wonderful. Computer science is wonderful. We have a programming language called Q-Sharp, amongst others, that can mimic these things. And I think it's something that we should look forward to in the future, solving some very interesting problems. But for right now, AI is like, we can do these things now. Quantum systems, there's some things we can do now, but we have to look forward to the future for some of the great things that it's going to do in the future. But hopefully that's helpful. I kind of went down the physics and the computer. It's a lot of stuff.
That was incredible. I feel I learned a lot. I'm very excited with your episode. I want to thank you for your time.
So glad to be here.
Yeah. And I want to leave the last minutes for you to share anything you want to share and also where people can find you and your podcast.
Absolutely. So my advice to everyone is pull on all the threads, be your authentic self, and you have something to contribute. Everyone does. If you want to look me up, just search for Seth Juarez. I have a website that I probably need to update. I'm also on Twitter with Seth Juarez or any other of the socials. Just search for me. I'm happy to answer any questions, or if you have something cool you want to show me, I'd be delighted to look at it.
Incredible. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.